Hello, hello, hello. People are still coming, so I guess we're going to give it a minute. Hello to all the virtual students. You tell me when to start, John. Okay, why don't we get going? I guess you know who I am, Lonnie Jarrett.
Lonnie Jarrett.
Yep, that's me. I don't think in all forms. But anyway, look, it's great to be here. Fantastic. And it's wonderful to meet you. So I'll be here through this evening. So if you see me, come over and say hello. And if you want to catch up and talk, I like meeting people. I got only halfway through my talk this morning. So the rest of the talk, the whole talk with the PowerPoint is up at my website, nourishingdestiny.com. And the version that's up is the one I gave as the opening talk to the AAMA convention in Atlanta last year. So they're the physicians who do acupuncture. And they honored me by letting me be either the first or one of the very first non-MDs to speak at the convention. And they gave me a standing ovation for that talk. They loved it. And I cannot figure out why. I finished the whole talk for them, but I was only halfway through it for you, and I can only think maybe I told more jokes this time. So, yes? On nourishingdestiny.com, there are four or five tabs, and one of them says library, and it would be in the library. And in the library, there are interviews I've done with Heiner Fruhoff and Zev Rosenberg and courses we've all done together. There are like 20 courses. Elizabeth Rochat has a 16-hour videotape course on women's health and the classics up there that we did together. So anyway, there's a lot up there. So here we are. So what am I going to talk about this afternoon? I'm going to talk about the basic notion. Look, we learn a lot of detailed diagnosis, right? A mind-blowing level of diagnosis. We all are at a pluralistic level of consciousness, a pluralistic level of cognitive development. Pluralistic level of consciousness means we're capable of holding many points of view simultaneously at the same time and seeing the relative strengths and their relative weaknesses. So rather than just saying, I'm Christian and everyone else is going to hell, or I'm Buddhist and everyone else doesn't get it, or, you know, right? Or I'm Burning Man and everyone can do what they want, it's just all about me. So rather than having that point of view or this point of view or the other, we can hold many points of view. So everyone in here relatively can... could look at a person's five-element constitutional type, their TCM pattern diagnosis, the pulse diagnosis in any of one or two or three systems that you've learned, three heater diagnosis. You could look at the six divisions of the way cold penetrates into the body, or the four divisions of heat. You could look at the 12 officials, and you could look at somebody's lab tests. You could study with me, you could study with Kiko, you could study with any of the teachers here, or seven of them, and take the best from each. And even if things were contradictory, even if I said to you that the woman Lillian Bridges, who gave this beautiful talk, said the area between the eyes is the spleen. Okay, so I would say it's the bladder, kidney, and liver. So which one of us is right? You hold everything contextually. You can learn information from competing systems and use it all in context, right? You can use it all in context. This is a very advanced form of consciousness. Your grandparents could not do this. Believe me. Even if you're six, your grandparents probably still can't do it. Well, maybe. Maybe if you're six. But if you're 30 and you're 40s, your grandparents and great-grandparents could not do this. It's a very evolved capacity. It really just came in after the Second World War. Right? We overthrew the church, we overthrew the state, you have your truth, I have my truth, nobody knows the truth. We all have our different points of view, and all points of view are considered equal. Right? So we got rid of hierarchy. All points of view are equal, except that all points of view aren't equal, because there's a downside to getting rid of hierarchy also. A downside to it. And the downside is everything becomes soup. A swamp. A flat swamp where nothing is higher than anything else. So we have all these advanced ways of diagnosing people. We're very advanced systems thinkers. Chinese medicine is very advanced systems theory, isn't it? But we can do it better than the ancient Chinese. That's a weird statement. How could that be so? Didn't they have all the action going in the Han Dynasty? Well, what did they know in the Han Dynasty about quantum physics? About nuclear physics? About digital electronics? What did they know in the Han Dynasty about Poland? Right? We live in one world now. Right? We live in one world. We have a form of consciousness. We're citizens of the world, and we have a form of consciousness that can look at tribalism and see the beauty in it and also the downside. And we can look at nationalism. We can look at mythic-centric consciousness. We have a top-down view on history that has never happened before, and it couldn't happen before due to geographic isolation and lack of information and communication. But now you just, as long as you have a wireless connection and an iPhone, you have access to all the culture in the human race. Right? The accumulated wisdom of the entire human race. I can now, when I wrote my first book, I would have to sit with a Chinese text with five English translations, six Chinese dictionaries, and take a day to figure out what a paragraph meant. And now I can go on and get just about any book in the Taoist canon and search it for the phrase that I want to find and go to every place that it occurs in seconds. So that's just the difference between 1995 and now. So things are changing very quickly. So even though we're able to cognize a lot of complexity at our level of development, what I find is that a lot of our relationship to the most important parts of what it means to be human is very abstract. It's very abstract. I'm on all the Chinese medicine news groups and I read all of it, and it's all a lot of abstraction. It's not just abstraction. There are some very bright people who have a lot to say. But there's a lot of abstraction. So while people can generate a very nuanced diagnosis when it comes to TCM pattern differentiation, I do pulse diagnosis. I've been studying it for 34 years. I studied with Leon Hammer 10 years. And when I take the pulse, I distinguish 9 levels on the pulse, 50 different positions, and about 60 different qualities. Fluently. I do 30 to 40 minute pulse diagnosis on all of my new patients. So that's a lot of detail. And the longer you practice Chinese medicine, the more nuanced your diagnosis gets. And what I find is that my students come in from the schools for the courses that I teach, and they know they got a much better education. The hardest thing I did in acupuncture school is trace around my hand and color in the acupuncture points. No, I'm not kidding. They'd have you lay on the floor, close the blinds, play the Pointer Sisters doing neutron dance, and then ask you to talk about your emotional experience. And I can't repeat for you what my emotional experience was. I can't. But so very nuanced diagnosis, very sophisticated systems theory, and people will argue about what a line means in a translation of Li Zhixian and what he meant, and they speak and they read Chinese at a very deep level, and it's very sophisticated, and you ask them to talk about what the human soul is, and they just give you a blank look. Well, it says in this text that the Hun is blah, blah, say blah, 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 and in 1317 in this province, so-and-so says, well, okay, but what's your experience of it? I don't understand what you mean. Well, this human soul, what's your experience of it? You see? So it all gets very intellectually abstract. And while it seems like we're all unique individuals with very unique realities, it turns out not to be really true. There are some basic, very basic, fundamental, universal mechanisms at work in all of us. And the sad fact is that the outcome of most people's lives is determined by genetic and cultural programming that they're not even aware that they have. Do you see? They're not even aware. They think that they're making freely willed decisions. I have found, in these news groups, by the way, that most people will go all the way arguing for a concept that they actually don't even believe in. It's just a machine running. They've never even subjected the idea that they're arguing for vehemently to any scrutiny to see if it actually makes any sense in their own experience. So I thought what I'd do, I'd like to set challenges to myself, for myself. And Jack invited me here, and I thought I'd give a course that I've never given before. So I thought, okay, let's title the course, To Know Your Patient, Know Yourself. To know your patient, know yourself. So the point is that really, we have all these ideas about channeling universal energy. We're going to bow into the treatment room and leave ourselves outside and be vehicles for some kind of cosmic energy. And I mean, look, wherever you go, there you are. And you're not going to, you can diagnose your patient's diseases without having had them. And you can even help them get over. You don't have to have had MS to treat MS. But the fundamental dimensions of self to really relate to another human being in a way that's going to be most moving and most influential and set the stage for the person self-authoring their own life. So the outcome of their life isn't determined by past karmic momentum of their people or their nation state or their genes or their family. We want the outcome of people's lives to be determined by their highest aspirations, their highest inspirations, their deepest intuition of the deepest truth that lies in their own heart. We want people to be more inspired by the future they're trying to create than debilitated by whatever past they've already had. So in this regard, I would say that I've never met a person whose past traumas were as compelling as their future potential. And yet when people come into treatment, most people have the idea that whatever happened to me, everyone else I know would have done better with it, but it affected me as deeply as it did because I'm so sensitive. But everybody thinks that. I've gone to 12 therapists, and I've had 4 gurus, and I have an 8-principle acupuncturist, and a 5-element acupuncturist, and a Kiko acupuncturist, and I have a shaman, and I do this, and I do that, and I do the other thing, and I have, you know, this kind of shaman down in Brazil, and I have another shaman up in Ottawa, and I go here, and I go there, and I do all these things. But there are a lot of seekers and not that many finders. You may have noticed. You may have noticed. So I think it's just what we're going to transmit to our patients is our own fundamental state of integrity, who we actually are. And to know the patient at their deepest level, we have to speak to it, and we're only going to be able to speak to the deepest heart, to the soul of the patient, to the spirit of the patient, to the deepest and highest part of the person, to the degree that we have a living relationship with those own dimensions within our own self. And that they're not just abstract, right? So if you talk about the Hun and the Po, I mean, all that stuff is fantastic, but who at a postmodern level of development can relate to it? Who even knows what they meant? Scholars can tell us what they think it means, but nobody really knows. Nobody really knows, right? Even if you got a Taoist priest now and he told you what it meant, it wouldn't be the same thing as talking to the person who wrote the Nanjing or the Neijing. And we can't do that. And listen, I mean, the classics are fantastic. I studied them for years. They're beautiful books. But the 9 Supreme Court justices, all of whom are fluent in English, don't agree on what the Constitution of the United States meant, and it was only written 240 years ago in their native tongue. Do you understand?
Yeah.
Do you understand?
Yeah.
Okay. So how much more difficult is it when you're interpreting a book written in a dead language 2,500 years ago? We can have opinions about it, and those opinions can inform, but the most important thing is to awaken to what the people were awakened to who wrote those books. You see, they were awake to something, and the thing they were awake to is living, and it's you in the deepest self. So it's important to have a real relationship, a non-abstract relationship with spirit, conscience, soul. Right? So you can lecture, you could write a PhD thesis on Shen in the Chinese classics. Believe me, you could write a doctoral thesis and come out having no lived experience of what it actually is. Do you see? So I think we're at a point of evolution and sophistication in our medicine where it becomes vitally important that the population of students and practitioners actually wake up to these things within ourselves. And it can't happen on the term of Han China, because we're postmodern people. And as I said this morning, and it's no joke, they never met a person who was not owned by the emperor. They never met a woman who wasn't property. They couldn't have conceived of it. If you ever want some entertainment, just get a book on the Confucian view of women. Some woman wrote a book on how to be a good wife in ancient China. Go read that. It'll be thrilling entertainment. So while we might fantasize about how enlightened these cats were who wrote the Nei Ching, there's no man or woman in this room who would have wanted to have been married to one of them. And that's very important to understand. We have to wake up to these universal things, spirit, every generation, spirit, soul, conscience. These things are evolving. They're not static. What conscience was 500 BC, it isn't now. We know so much more, and we'll know more tomorrow than we know today. And 50 years from now, we'll know more. And if we have the right attitude and we're on board, look, we're all just getting started with this. If you took all the books on betrayal, love, and victimization out of a New Age bookstore, you'd be left with, like, roadmaps. There wouldn't even be any cooking books. Right? So you'd be left with, like, yeah, roadmaps and the mini key rings that are hanging up. So, and you know, we've only had culture really 4,000 years, really. And in terms of what love and trust and intimacy is, in terms of these capacities, we're really just getting started. So while the schools have really advanced and the profession has advanced a lot since I came into it, certainly, which was 1980, you know, it's all good, but there's a lot more depth that we could have, a lot more depth. So I just thought I'd talk. So what I'm presenting today is just the leading edge of my own investigation. I'm not giving you anything definitive. I'm not telling you what the soul is. I mean, it's an infinite inquiry. It's emergent. It's evolving. It's evolving as we sit here. It's evolving at the leading edge. So we're involved in a process of cosmic evolution. Everything is moving. The planet's whizzing through space at hundreds of thousands of miles an hour, spinning. And everything out there that seems fixed is moving. Right? And this is, I mean, the Buddhists knew this, and the Taoists and the Hindus knew this, but we realize it on a much larger scale, on a much more significant scale. Again, Albert Einstein thought that the universe was the size of our solar system. Scientists pointed the Hubble telescope at a single pinpoint of empty space for 12 days and discovered 100 billion galaxies in it. 100 billion the size of our own. That would have blown even Einstein's mind. He might have said, maybe God does play dice with the universe. So, to know the patient, know the self. The goal of treatment is to disembed consciousness from conditioning. all kinds of conditioning. There's genetic conditioning, there's karmic conditioning, cultural conditioning, gender conditioning, ethnic conditioning. For the people who live around here, do you know the difference between somebody who lives in San Diego, Berkeley, San Francisco, and Oakland? Those are real distinctions, right? I'm from New York, and the difference between East Village, West Village, Uptown, Downtown, Jersey, Westchester, Queens, North Shore, South Shore, worlds apart. If somebody says he's from the South Shore, everybody knows what they're talking about. Do you understand? So on the one hand, we don't want to be prejudiced. On the other hand, we have to acknowledge that there are cultural distinctions between people. Okay? And we have more information at our fingertips than we've ever had before, and we're conditioned by more sources, more mediated than any human beings have ever been before. Right? So that's very important to understand. The point of treatment is to disembed this. We need to remove the patient as the source of the problem and liberate an impulse within an individual that has a direction, an inherent direction of its own. So we're going to spend time talking about what the spirit is, what the soul is, the distinction between mind and consciousness, what conscience is, and I'm hoping to get through at least part of this. I'll get through part of it today. We'll see how far we get. And feel free to jump in any...
What do you mean by mediated?
Mediated?
Yeah.
A culture is telling you how things are and what things are.
You get the five big music organizations.
Yeah. Your relationship to love is more affected by things like movies and newspapers and the internet now than it is with direct relationship with the experience of it. Do you see what I mean? People have 50-inch flat screen TVs with pictures of water flowing on them as opposed to looking out the window at a river. That's mediation. Do you understand? We're destroying the environment and the world of the mind is exploding on the internet.
Yeah, James Cameron came up with a beautiful idea. He called it a collective hallucination.
Well, Buddha said the same thing. He didn't use those terms, but... Right, but it's not all bad. Language, from a certain perspective, language is one of the most highly evolved capacities of the universe. Why? Because it's all in the interest of self-discovery. It's the same thing speaking that's listening. Do you see? So you can say, well, Lonnie's speaking and I'm sitting in this chair listening, but it's the same thing speaking that's listening. Right? Am I separate from the universe in some mysterious way? Aren't I the universe? Aren't I as much the earth as a tree? Am I less the earth than a tree? Didn't the earth produce me? It produced you. So with all the earth, we're all the universe. What's speaking and what's listening, it's the same thing. You understand? What's looking through the Hubble telescope and what's being seen are the same thing. So you look through the Hubble telescope and you see these 100 billion galaxies and the response is, oh my God, did I do that? That's what I've been up to for 15 billion years? You mean I didn't start this 6,000 years ago? Which never worked for me anyway, because if I'm in heaven, there are no large man-eating lizards living in it. Like Garden of Eden, never made sense for me. Garden of Eden, mammals walking around naked with T-Rex. Just doesn't really work. Anyway. Okay. So I'm going to draw a chart here. We're just going to do a brief review of Chinese physiology. You have this chart. You don't have to draw it down. It's in the conference book that they gave you. So Lao Tzu said that he basically started his book saying, whatever you can say about it isn't it. So Lao Tzu is on his way to die. He's on the back of a donkey. He shows up at the Western Pass, the Metal Gate. That's the name of CV1, Metal Gate. CV1 is the exit from the womb and the entry to the tomb. It's the gate we go through when something comes from nothing and we incarnate into this life. And it's the gate we go back through when we die. cosmologically. So it's the name of bladder 63, the urinary bladder, which on a physical level, the water is flowing and leaving, and CV1, right, has to do with the womb and the tomb. So the Chinese version of Kali would be Ziwangmu, the Queen Mother of the West. She lives on Kunlun Mountain. She's the first Taoist immortal that was a woman. Laozi goes on the back of a donkey to the Western Pass, and the gatekeeper says, "Not so fast. Before you die, you have to leave us a book of your accumulated wisdom. Fulfill your destiny by leaving us a book." He says, "Fine, but what I have to talk about has no name. But if forced to give it a name, I'll call it the Tao, and the Tao is one." But now we have two things. We have the unborn Tao, which we can't put on the board. It's beyond the mind. It's inconceivable to the mind. What I'm calling mind cannot contain it. So we have the unnamed Tao, and we have the named Tao. And the named Tao is one. But now we have two things. We have heaven, and we have earth. But now we have, what's that a picture of, by the way? It's the womb, the uterus, and the ovaries. So now we have three things, because there's heaven and earth, and they're incubating something, and what they're incubating is chi. And the kind of chi that they're incubating I drew this backward, but it's chungqi. Chungqi. So we have the character for water, and we have an arrow in the center of a target, and it means whirlpool. Whirlpool or geyser. Something coming from nothing. You know, like out in Yellowstone, Old Faithful, you have nothing, and then out of emptiness, there's an explosion, an entire universe emerges. Something comes from nothing. So we have Chengqi. And the function of Chengqi is to keep, when we do Qigong, we're keeping heaven and earth apart. And then we bring them together at the level of heart. So the function of Qi is to hold in place, and then to interpenetrate, to bring things together, to mix. Those are two other functions. The third function is to warm, to incubate. They're incubating a fetus. And what fetus are they incubating? The manifest world. So at the moment of conception, heaven and earth come together as the father's sperm, the mother's egg, the father's jing, the mother's blood. At the moment of conception, the light from the moon, the stars, and the sun shines. The Big Dipper, seven stars in the Big Dipper, having names Tai Yin, Tai Yang, Xiao Yin, Xiao Yang, Zhui Yin. Six of the stars, having those names, and the central star is Tian Shu, Heavenly Pivot, stomach 25. So the North Star is the belly button, stomach 25, heavenly pivot. We have the Big Dipper, a spoon, spinning around in the night sky. At the moment of conception, the father's jing hits the mother's blood. The light, heaven, earth, moon, stars, sun. It's the left half of the character Shen. The light from the moon, the stars, and the sun shines into the Big Dipper. The Big Dipper is a spoon. It takes an apportionment of the night sky. It gives it to you as your jing, and the moon, the stars, the sun imprint a destiny, a fire within it. And that fire is to rise during life up the spine and awaken to itself as self in the heart and in the mind. To know itself through the vehicle. The body is a vehicle for this light to recognize itself within the vehicle. And then human beings have free will. You can recognize yourself as that and then ignore it, right? So the average life of a person might look something like, right? Or you can recognize that and say, "Oh, I'm a vehicle for the expression of that. I owe my life to that. It's not my life. It's the life of this impulse. Not mine, but thine. Not my will, but thy will." So, we have the one replicated here as Jing. If we have the one, we have to have two. And corresponding to heaven, we have the yang qi in the... yang qi in the left kidney. The... I did this backwards. Should be earth on the left, heaven on the right. Yin, yang in the right kidney. So what we have here, the character for primordial, yuan qi, again, like shen, heaven, earth. And then here we have the stream, the wires, the jing, the connectivity back down to the primordial source. So we have the yuan qi, we have the yin, we have the yang, and between them, instead of qi, we have what? The gate of destiny, ming men, gate of life, gate of destiny. At this higher state of differentiation, the jing is the infinite ocean of potential out of which all manifestations we're capable of arise. The jing is an infinite ocean. Just as the Tao is the infinite ocean, the nothing that something comes from, the nothing that something comes from, our jing is that infinite ocean of potential out of which all manifestations arise. And what rises up over the infinite ocean is the sun, the shen. So on the left, on the right-hand side of the character, we have two hands extending a rope. Through that rope, it's a character. The moon, the stars, the sun, the light shines to us, represents heaven extending its will toward us and offering a way up. So that's the character for spirit. So the function of the gate of destiny, Ming Men, is to infuse our primordial yin with our primordial yang and our jing with our shen. Hard to write sideways. Okay. Everything on the left side of that line is the endowment we get between the moment of conception and our first breath. This is called early heaven. It's called pre-heaven or anterior heaven, meaning it's the heaven, it's the investment of heaven within us from the moment of conception to the moment of first breath. It's our genetics and it's our inborn karma. We all know, right, that the moment of conception isn't neutral. At the moment of your conception, besides your mother and father, who was there? Who was that single cell, sperm hits egg? Who was it? It's you. But you didn't need psychotherapy then. You didn't need Bujang Ichitang. You didn't need to talk about it. Right? You didn't need to, there's nothing to work out. There was no problem because nothing had happened yet. So everything on this side of the line is inborn, constitutional. So when we talk about constitution, either genetic or five element constitution, there are two ways to use the word constitutional. We can say everyone has a five element constitution, right? Water, wood, fire, earth, or metal. But we can also say something's constitutional. For instance, if you have a weak left proximal pulse in a child who's 7 years old and they have asthma, that's an inborn constitutional weakness. They couldn't have worked so hard by 7 years old that they depleted their kidney chi. They just didn't get enough, right? And if you have a 97-year-old with a weak proximal kidney pulse, don't worry about it. They're doing well if they drove in for treatment. So we have to integrate from first breath on what's called later heaven or posterior heaven, acquired sources of qi. And how do we integrate acquired sources of qi? How do they come to us? They come to us through the sensory orifices. We breathe. We have seven holes in the head. How many stars in the Big Dipper? 7 stars in the Big Dipper, 7 holes in the head to perceive the light from those stars. The influences of heaven coming to us. So the way we acquire chi from heaven is through bladder 1. Small intestine 19. Eyes bright. Do you know the name of bladder 1 in the Nei Ching was Ming Men, Gate of Destiny? Because when the fires of Ming Men burn brightly, that brightness shines through the eyes. And it was changed later in history, so you wouldn't have 2 points with the exact same name, I would presume, to eyes bright. And the idea then is that brightness is the fire of original nature burning deep within one's heart and between the kidneys, coming out into the world as what? As passion, as interest, as intelligence, as acuity of hearing, acuity of seeing, acuity of smell, acuity of taste, acuity of touch. So we have all these points on the head by the sensory orifices. Do people know what the entry-exit points are? So we know on every channel there's points where chi leaves to go to the next channel, and every channel has points to receive from the previous channel. And we know they're not always the first and last point. So the entry point on colon is colon 4, the exit point on kidney is kidney 22, where the chi goes to pericardium 1. So we're talking about the Chinese clock. So what's interesting, isn't it, is that the yin entry exit points all bring chi through the heart, and the yang entry exit points all bring chi through the mind. So we have small intestine 19, bladder 1, triple heater 22, gallbladder 1, and colon 20, stomach 1. Right? All have to do with the mind and the orifices of the mind, the 7 holes in the head, whereas the yin entry exit points all have to do with the heart orifice, bringing chi and blood through the heart. Okay, so it would be very good news if the integrity of these relationships were maintained. Right? So if there were no pollution, if there was no pollution, and Monsanto hadn't genetically engineered all the rice and corn on the planet, and you hadn't eaten that Clark bar at lunch, then heaven within would correspond to heaven without, and the window between them would be clear. Right? The window between would be clear. So we have several sources of input that tint this filter, tint a screen. There's a filter between our capacity to have experience and to actually experience that experience. There's a filter between what you hear, what you see, what's happening. I'm talking to you now, but you're not hearing what I'm saying. You're hearing what you're thinking about what I'm saying. I know this because, to my horror, when my students go on break, I walk around and I read their notes. And my patients come in and they say, "What you said last week has changed my life forever." And I always hold my breath a moment and say, "What did I say?" And they go, "Blah, blah, blah." They repeat what I said, and it's nothing I would have ever told anybody. It can be diametrically opposed to anything I ever thought in my life. So I learned very early in clinical practice that there's a big difference between what's actually happening and what a person's making of it. And we know that in a simple way in Chinese medicine, right? Because where I live in Massachusetts, nobody is exposed to wind heat in February when it's 60 degrees below with wind chill factor. But people come in with wind heat, but that's what they made of what they experienced. It wasn't what they experienced. Do you understand? Everyone understand the analogy? It's the same thing across the board. So the thing is, we have a filter here between our capacity to take information in and what we actually make out of it. So what's going into Ming Men is not always the truth. We have a fire rising. Something is coming from nothing. There's an explosion of something coming from nothing. Theoretically, it should be a straight line. The straight line The metaphor for the straight line is the perfectly straight back during meditation. And what's the first character in the Chinese language? Heaven. No deviation. In Shen, first line, the one. So Shen is the one, and then the Chinese number two, and then the Chinese number three. One, two, three. The character for spirit is recapitulating the ontogeny of the universe because that is the impulse that's arising. That is the something coming from nothing, a straight line of spirit. So the character in the Tao Te Ching, the character for virtue, is a picture of a human standing, moving. They're like walking. And they can be looked at in every direction. So we have the character 10, every direction, the five elements. But the person, as they travel through life, can be looked at with the eye in every direction and no deviation can be found in their heart. It's the character for virtue. The character for virtue. It also stands in the infant, its original nature, and in the adult, the realized adult, its virtue. And those are the virtues I talked about that Sri Aurobindo talked about this morning, right? Virtues like integrity and wisdom and reciprocity and propriety corresponding to fire, righteousness corresponding to metal. So we have pollution coming in, the clock bars. We have the media telling us what things are, defining who we are and how things are for us, telling us all kinds of nonsense, the educational systems, pouring all kinds of information into us, defining reality for us. But there's an even bigger foe than the Illuminati or Clear Channel. There's an even bigger foe, and the bigger foe happens to be, ironically enough, but fortunately for us, because it's the one thing we can take on of our own free will that no one can stop us from taking on, which is our own mind. It's our own mind. So wherever you go, there you are. The biggest problem most of our, not all our patients, but the biggest problem, put it this way, the biggest problem every patient has that they can take 100% responsibility for is their own mind. Do you see? The biggest problem every patient has that they can take 100% responsibility for is their own mind. And when people do this, it's deeply inspiring. Christopher Reeves, quadriplegic from the neck down, but it didn't slow him up at all. They had to rewrite all the neurobiology textbooks on regeneration in the central nervous system just through the sheer force of his own will. Nelson Mandela, 28 years in a prison cell. So the one thing that's in our hand is our own integrity. And that integrity always exists in relationship to our own mind. This filter works the same way in all of us. It has different qualities. Different qualities. There's gender conditioning. You may have noticed a subtle difference between men and women. Anyone ever notice that subtle difference? It's bigger than the difference between people from Queens and Manhattan, I can tell you that. So there can be a five-element tint on the window. There can be constitutional TCN syndrome patterns that people just come into life with. They just come in destined to have these patterns, so they're karmic. There's gender conditioning, nationalistic conditioning. I saw a guy, I was at a county fair, and he had a t-shirt saying, "Not only am I perfect, I'm German too." Which says a lot about the German national conditioning. So we all have conditioning, but we also have a measure of free will. Nobody has absolute free will because nobody exists independently of conditioning. Nobody, not the Buddha. The notion that the Buddha was perfect human being is a myth. It arose at the same time in history as the notion that, actually it arose prior. But it occurred during the Axial Age. Lao Tzu didn't die. He went to heaven on the back of a crane. Do you understand? And if you kill yourself in jihad, you'll get 50 virgins when you die. And 72. They keep raising the number to make it more. No, nobody will go for 50 anymore. And it's up there with the notion that, you know, perfected gurus walk on water and virgins give birth to children. It's mythic. It's mythic. That whole conception of a guru as a perfected vehicle is mythic. Now, in a line of development, they may be extraordinarily high. Miles Davis, in his musical line of development, was a million miles high. But in his personality, he was like a demon. Right? So we know that people can be very, very high in a line of development. So in a spiritual line of development, right, someone like Buddha would blow your mind. But he didn't want women. He said they're never going to get enlightened. Why should I teach them? How enlightened is that? From our perspective, that's ignorant. So how could he have been a perfected Buddha and have said that? Do you understand? So then you have to ask the question, what really is enlightenment? And maybe we'll get to that.
I know Buddha only said that won't be done now. Buddha's teaching will be stopping 500 years early.
If I let women in, the teaching won't last.
No, if that woman become a nun, usually a woman cannot be a nun.
Right.
Something in Christ is, because of that, the Buddhist teaching will be, those general teaching will be stopped 500 years earlier than the mission.
Right, well anyway, we've come further. Okay, so what I want to talk about in part today is just how this filter works and what the nature of the filter is. But the basic image is this. You're driving along in a car, and bugs get on the windshield, dirt gets on the windshield, mud get on the windshield, stone hits the windshield, birds poop on the windshield, right? You hit deer, right in New England. You're driving down the road, you hit deer, and if your car isn't totaled, that gets on the window. And the thing is, well, at 70 miles an hour, a deer will take out a BMW straight in half all the way back to the driver's seat. But, you know, you got to pay to play. So the point is you're fixated on this window and you're watching everything go by through it, and eventually you forget that you're the one watching it and you become identified with all the contents on the window. And then over a million years of evolution, you just forget that you're actually not in the movie, you're watching the movie. You're not in the movie, you're watching the movie. The whole point is that what seems to you to be the subject, which is you, becomes just an object in your own awareness. Right? What the subject, you step far enough back, and the very self, your own very own self, becomes a rather finite and small object. See, I thought this was me. And I stand back and I say, what I thought was me actually isn't me. I'm what's looking at it. See, I thought I had all this stuff to work out in this very small, personal, very constricted and painful sphere. And actually, I can just drop it. It was never me anyway. Do you see? So we want to practice medicine in a way that has no inherent sense of limitation. And we certainly don't want to reinforce in people the illusion that they are their own suffering, that they are their own suffering. They're the consciousness aware of the suffering. And then we want to know what are the properties of that consciousness, what are the capacities in that, what is the inclination of that, because that never had a problem, it doesn't have a problem, and it won't ever have a problem. And it's glad to be here. It doesn't take the point of view, I never asked to be born. it's not separate in any way from the impulse that is motivating the whole of cosmic evolution. Now, I know that sounds very big, and you say, well, what does that have to do with the practice of Chinese medicine? Well, minimally, it has this. I have discovered in my clinical practice that people are absolutely convinced that they have problems. Have you ever noticed this? They're absolutely convinced they have problems. Some of them are convinced they have problems, and they've been talking about those problems, $150 for a 45-minute hour once a week, since the 50s. And that's really convinced them that now they have two problems. One, they didn't put that money in the stock market. They invested it in psychotherapy. And the other problem is that now they have, you know, when you spend a lot of money on something, you have a deep investment in thinking you got a really good one? Well, now they have that problem too. Okay. So what I've realized, what I've awoken to, which not just me, anyone who awakens to the realization of, oh, there is no problem. There isn't any problem. There never was a problem. That doesn't mean that life isn't very challenging or even very painful or very scary or very difficult. It's just that if you're paying attention, it's just not where the action is. It just isn't the most compelling thing. Do you understand? It's just not the most exciting thing. So if you're going to activate that realization in a patient, because look, everyone when they get out of your acupuncture treatment is 45 minutes to an hour closer to their own death. You only get so much time. So everybody's body is going to die. Everybody's body is going to die. So in the deepest and highest aspects of what we do, we just don't want people to die ignorant deaths. We want people to get out of their own way and not wait to be happy and to really... We don't want people to wait to live till it's too late. Someone was telling me at breakfast this morning how a mutual friend of ours, how his wife had died very young, and how in the last 6 months of her life she became like a Buddha. Right, and really awakened, took care of everything in life that was important. You don't want to wait till you get a terminal diagnosis. You want to be free now. Right? I mean, the Super Bowl is going on. We don't want to be in the locker room doing push-ups, getting ready to be ready. We don't want to be getting ready to be ready. Do we understand? Okay. The taxi's waiting and the guy's out there going, let's go. The guy's God. Let's go. The meter's running. Only so much time. People are going, sorry, I still got stuff to work out. Still got problems to work out. So we want to look at how this filter works. Okay, very good. So let me define a few terms and talk about a few things here. I want to talk about, I'm just going to define the mind, what I mean by the word mind. Now listen, it's fair enough that everyone would define it a different way. I'm not telling you what the mind is. Who the knows? I mean, Freud didn't discover the mind. He operationally defined it. He looked at the mind and said, this is what it means to me. And William James said, this is what it means to me. I'm just telling you, when I use the word mind, what I mean. Your mileage may totally vary. It's fair enough, it's an inquiry. I wouldn't trust anyone who purported to tell you what the human mind was. It would be arrogant, right? It's just an inquiry, it's evolving. Our knowledge is evolving on all this. So when I talk about the human mind, I'm talking about an evolutionarily evolved mechanism that emerges from the human nervous system. It stores data. It stores and recalls your experience in the form of thought, feeling, emotion, and sensation. And it also draws conclusions about the meaning of that input relative to your past experience. Okay? So the mind evolves from the nervous system. It's a byproduct of neurophysiological action. You've got a hard disk. As you, every moment you're sitting in the chair now, you hear me talking, the mind is storing everything you're aware of in this room and everything you're not aware of. That's in your conscious and unconscious experience. You feel your butt on the chair, you feel the breeze, you hear the person next to you. Maybe there's some subsonic noise, there are people talking in the next room muffled through the wall, there's, you know, people riding bikes out there and someone puts on their brakes, and everything is all streaming constantly, and you're aware of some small part of it, right? And you're not aware of a lot other, and you're drawing conclusions about what things mean in relationship to you. In relationship to you. What does this mean for me? What does this mean for me? What does this mean about me? Me, 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 me. The mind is the hard disk that stores the personal sphere of experience. The personal sphere of experience. I was born April 21st, 7:49 a.m., 1958. I have 55 years of experience up to this moment. The moment I die, all of those individual moments of time that occur to me as defining a unique self will no longer be held together by my nervous system, and they will go poof. Do you understand? And as far as I know, although mathematicians say that we all exist in infinite universes, but who knows? We just deal with the right here and right now. But as far as I know, I'm the only one who'll ever have had that experience. I'll have been the only one in this process of evolution for that number of years at the moment I die, and that unique perspective will all go poof. Do you understand? It's finite. It's inherently limited. It seems like a continual stream of a continual self in time, but that's an illusion of the nervous system, of the human nervous system. So what I'm calling the mind is born in time. Time arises with mind. If you ever meditate, if you ever really meditate, what you're doing then is you're letting go of your mind. You're letting go of all the contents within your mind. Isn't it interesting that you can make a choice, a freely willed choice, to have no relationship to the contents of your own mind? Well, if you can make a freely willed choice to have no relationship to the contents of your mind, you cannot be the mind. The mind is occurring in your sphere of experience. The nature of that filter is it keeps your intention focused on that finite sphere of experience and keeps you therefore identified with it as self in denial of all the dimensions of your own experience which aren't personal. So one of the ways that filter works, and we can call that filter ego, and I'm using a spiritual, not a psychological definition of ego. So from a spiritual perspective, we could say that ego is the denial of reality. In the context of what I'm talking about right now, ego is just the force of keeping your attention at all times, in all places, through all circumstances, focused on the finite and very personal sphere of your own experience. And this is the reason that the most educated, well-nourished, politically, socially, sexually free people who ever lived are getting all the psychotherapy and taking all the Prozac, and needing all the time to work out their problems and all the time to heal. We have now had 113 years of psychotherapy. Hot tubs at Esalen, ayahuasca, tantric sex, chocolate mud packs, five element acupuncture, eight principle acupuncture, chiropractic. I could sit here listing it all day long. We've had 100 years of that stuff. And people are fundamentally miserable, spending all of the rest of their life is dedicated to overcoming whatever portion of life they've already lived. No matter what age they are. No matter what age they are. You understand? I had a big awakening. I did this program, which I'm sure out here in California you're all aware of, and maybe some painfully, called EST, which is like Landmark. Now, I did two weekends, and the first one I did was one of the major experiences of my younger life, and I got a lot of value out of it. But I did it in the town I lived in, rural New England, and out of the 60 people in the room, 45 of them had been my patients. And I'd been practicing there full-time since 1986, and seeing 60, 70 patients a week back then. I was very ambitious. And there were no other acupuncturists for 50 miles, so now there are 40, and but that's a whole nother story. And so so I practiced for 5 or 6 years by the time I did this program. 45 of the people I took the program with, you were supposed to get up in front of the room and tell your story to people. And one after one, people came up and they told their life story as if it was just a dawning awareness in their own consciousness, and they had never conveyed it to another human being before. And I was like, oh my God, these people had represented to me that they had gotten over this stuff. They said, Lonnie, this acupuncture. Acupuncture was pretty new back then, right? So I was the first acupuncturist for lots and lots of people, because this is out in a rural town in New England. And they said, what you're doing is the most powerful medicine, and it's helped me gotten over this, and it's so much more important than, it helped me more than chiropractic. And one, I have these letters, someday I'm going to publish all this stuff. I have these letters, people telling me, one session with you did more than 17 years of psychotherapy, and then 6 years later you're there and they're talking about it, breaking down in tears in the room, as if they had, it was, they were just woke up from a dream and remembered that it happened. And after the 45th person did this, I had this real awakening of the impersonal structures that were at work and how identified people were at their core with the problem, and that the workshop they were taking was actually just entertainment. They were going to have another big experience, which was going to be the most important thing they had ever done. So if somebody's a seeker for 10 years, that's very impressive. And if someone's a seeker for 20 years, you have to respect how earnest they are. But if they're a seeker for 30 years, you have to start getting suspicious. And if they're a seeker for 40 years, you have to conclude this person really likes taking workshops. But the point is not just to consume experience and have mind-blowing experiences. The point is to find meaning in it and an obligation. And you can't find an obligation if all truth is relative, because, hey man, I'm just living my truth. And you say, well, how was the workshop this weekend? It was mind-blowing. How are you going to change your life in relationship to it? Whoa. It's going to take me a while to integrate this back into my life. Right? I have to integrate it back into my life. But you can't fit something which is inherently limited and finite into that which is unborn, undying, and infinite. It's quite the other way around, right? The finite has to dissolve. The single drop has to dissolve into the ocean. So you've got this turtle who goes into the ocean and takes off his shell and meditates. And he takes off his shell and he says, I'm so free. I'm so free. But he keeps one finger on the shell. Just in case, you see? Because to do this for a trillionth of a second, in that trillionth of a second of letting go, that shell could get away. And then you'd never go back in. You would never go back in. And if the shell gets away and you can't get back in, you are exposed. The difference between you and that ocean, it's not going to be very well defined. You're going to start to understand yourself not as a fixed entity, a rock on a table, but as a dynamic process of dynamic flow. Now, the Taoists knew this, but they thought the flow went in circles. There is a dimension of the flow that goes in circles, but there's a mind-blowing, infinite dimension of it, which is going straight ahead toward deeply and more highly integrated states, increasing complexity, toward the true, the good, the beautiful. And we want to be vehicles for that emergence, not just feeling peace. Not just feeling peace. We want to be vehicles, not just the peace in the clinic. Meet the patient where they are. Don't ever meet a patient where they are. Why? You're cheating them. They're already where they are. So you don't want to... What is the point in using medicine to help a person be more comfortable where they are? Unless they just had a child die, they were raped 3 days ago, they're just going through a divorce, they're dying of cancer and it's terribly painful. There are moments to help people be where they are. But unless you're dealing mostly with a terminal population, and imminently, we all deal with terminal populations exclusively, but an imminently terminal population, you don't want to meet people where they are. You want to bring them higher, right? Deeper, which means you have to know the higher parts of yourself and the deeper parts of yourself and have a real living relationship to them. And you can't do that if it's all one soup and every voice in your head is just, well, this is what my ego wants and this is what my conscience wants. This is what my spirit wants and my soul wants. But this, you know, and it's all just good. So now I feel like being spiritual and now I feel like, you know, being an egomaniac or a narcissist. Right? At some point, a choice has to be made. So, the way the human mind, what I'm calling the human mind, works, what it is a machine, and it is built to know. It is built to know. It can't not know. It can only know. And when it doesn't know, the emotion fear arises. And in the presence of the emotion fear, it makes stuff up. It makes stuff up. So you can just do a very easy experiment. You put go buy a lottery ticket and put it in your wallet. Now here's the truth. You don't know whether you're going to win or lose, right? You don't know. And your mind will fluctuate back and forth between I wasted a dollar, how will I spend my $247 million? Nobody buys a lottery ticket and goes, maybe I'll win $78. Right? So the mind goes 13 million, 18 million, 270 million, 470 million. So the mind, when it doesn't know, is binary and it goes back and forth between the best case scenario and the worst case scenario. This is how it works in everyone. So a woman comes in and she has felt a lump in her breast and it's going to take 4 days to get to her general practitioner, 2 weeks to have diagnostics on it, and a week to get the result back. So you have a month. And she doesn't know. And her mind is going back and forth between, it's probably just a fibrocystic cyst, and my life is over. It's nothing, and I am dead. And then in that month, she will be more interested in doing the right thing now without an excuse and without taking any more time therapeutically to get to the point of feeling like doing what she already knows is the right thing. And if those diagnostics come back and she's clean, she'll come back in she'll be like she used to be, with no interest in anything higher and deeper at all. And you say, but what about everything we were working on and everything you said and all these insights you had? She goes, oh, you know, well. Right? So some guy comes in and his partner has said, I'm leaving you. And all of a sudden, miraculously, he wants to work on the relationship, and he's very interested. But 3 minutes after either finding a new partner or the old partner coming back, all his interest, all the possibility he saw in the relationship, don't you understand? We shouldn't get divorced. This is an opening. We can blow all this stuff out. There's so much we can see now. Right? But as soon as the woman or the, you know, his male partner or whatever comes back, or as soon as he finds someone new, there's no interest at all. Do you see? No interest at all. Spirit, the evolutionary dimension of spirit, reveals itself in crisis. Right? So when somebody does get a terminal diagnosis, all of a sudden many people become interested in resolving all the conflict in their life, seeing through the trauma, communicating what they should be doing, finally stopping smoking, finally doing this, finally doing that. Don't want to wait till then. When I was a kid, my mother had this extensive library. She collected books, and we had a significant library in our house. I mean, floor-to-ceiling shelves on four walls of the living room. And I found the Tibetan Book of the Dead and all the Confucian and Taoist and Buddhist classics and the Bhagavad Gita, the Ramayana, and all the Vedic sutras, for instance. And I read the Tibetan Book of the Dead. Anyone in here ever read that? Okay, it's incomprehensible. If you have time afterwards, explain to me what it meant, because it's like Bardo this and Bardo that, and it's written in this totally ridiculous, hard-to-read English. So I got one thing from it. And what I got is, when you die, go toward the light. And I actually, as a 14 or 15-year-old, I felt a lot of relief. Got it, thank God, I can do whatever I want. And as long as I go toward the white light, I am good. And I really don't think it works that way. As I said today, earlier, I really just think you're going to keep doing then what you're doing now for exactly the same reasons. Do you see? So the thing is to not think that you're going to get enlightened when you're dead. We all want to wake up. Wake up now. And waking up can just really mean just starting to take ourselves seriously. It just means taking the impulse which is seeking within you, the part that brought you to this conference, the thing that has you staying in this room and not leaving, the thing that has you interested, the thing that got you to go to Chinese medicine school, come to this conference, read the books, that impulse to go further and deeper and higher is only looking for itself. It isn't looking for anything else. And people will spend incarnations following the impulse to seek, looking out there. I mean, this is just the basic message in Wizard of Oz. It's nothing new, really. So the mind is a machine. It fills in the blank. It fills in the blank. It can only cognize the meaning of things. Right? It can only cognize meaning. When it doesn't know what a thing means, it makes it up. When the ego conditions the mind, whenever it doesn't know the meaning of something, it makes up a meaning relevant to you and writes that information into this limited context, into this finite context. The hall of mirrors that is ego, the personal self, the personal sphere of where every mirror in there is reflecting I, me, mine. Right? I, me, mine. It's the last song the Beatles recorded when they all hated each other. Right? I, me, me, mine. Right? So that's the ego. So the ego knows who I am, how life is, and where I am, but only in the context of this limited sphere. The ego is the egoically conditioned mind is a function that helps us locate ourselves. Now, it's good to be able to locate yourself. There's nothing wrong with the sphere, you understand? The fact that I can locate myself means I knew that I had to teach it to and come to this room. It means I will know to call the front desk, say, give me a wake-up call at 5, get a flight out tomorrow morning, and I know I'm supposed to go back to Massachusetts. It's good to have a record of the past. The problem becomes when that's a person's only experience of self. And this filter, one of the mechanisms of it, is to keep all attention solely on that personal sphere. The problem with taking the finger off for even a trillionth of a second is that you may see something, so that the person who gets off the pillow is not the person who sat down. You may see something that changes your values. And when your values change, things that seemed very, very important might be revealed to be insignificant. Things that weren't even on your radar screen might become all-consuming. And most significantly, your relationships with other people are going to change. Because the people you were in relationships with who are still holding your old values will be, those relationships will be revealed to a degree to be unwholesome, because you have just moved from a relatively less wholesome state to a relatively more wholesome state of greater integrity. greater vision, greater depth, more inclusive consciousness, more expansive consciousness, able to cognize and hold more complexity. And people, the ego's main function that it's committed to is maintaining the status quo. It's the conservative in your head. It's the part of the self that doesn't want anything to change. It loves taking workshops. All this is so interesting. It's all so interesting, and you should... Oh, that darshan the other night was just so beautiful, and my heart was exploding like a thousand suns. Interesting, because you're still the same so-and-so. And I'm not being cynical. I'm not a cynical person at all. It's just that we consume experience with no expectation that we should actually change. You see? No expectation of actually changing. So I'd like to draw a distinction between meditation, contemplation, and thinking. It's important to have that distinction because they get kind of... It is the mind that thinks. So thinking means, should I buy this house or should I buy that house? And this is what they're asking for this, and this is the appraised value, and this is what they're asking for that, and this is the appraised value. And this one's near all the good sushi bars, but this one's near the art school. Do you understand? And I can get a loan on this one at this percent. And you're lining up the data and you're just doing a balanced one and this one wins. So that's thinking. It's analysis. And it's good to be able to do analysis. It's a good function of the mind. We can create art and poetry and science and bicycles and acupuncture and all this fantastic stuff. So what is the difference between thought, contemplation, and meditation? Meditation is the contemplation of nothing. Contemplation is meditating on something. So meditation is the contemplation of nothing, no thing. So in meditation, I sit up, I cross my legs, I sit with my back straight, and I take a position of having no relationship to the content and quality of my experience. I am renouncing my mind. I'm not trying to have a different experience. I'm not trying to not have thoughts. If you try to not have thoughts, you are not meditating. If you have any expectation of having no thought, that has nothing to do with meditation. Meditation is not any specific experience. It's a position one takes in relationship to any and all experience. And that relationship is no relationship. So in no relationship, which means anything that arises, you have no relationship. People who live in New York are very good at no relationship. So you walk through the streets, you know, Times Square back in the 60s and 70s, when there were hookers. You walk through Times Square, hookers and pimps, gun dealers, people go, Sinsemia, hey, you want to buy a gun? Right? You want to buy a shirt? You want to buy a phony Rolex watch? Right? You get everything, and what you do is you have no relationship. Anyone ever been to India? If you've been to India, you know it. No, what happens if you have a relationship to a beggar and give him a rupee? It's like The Walking Dead couldn't budget a scene like this. Right? So you give a rupee to one beggar, and then 5,000 people on the street turn to you and start walking and following it. Some woman chased me 3 blocks and we were crossing the street, and I looked down and there were like 4 rupees on the ground, and I pointed to them and she looked at me and just kept following me down the street. She wasn't going to bend over for 4 rupees because she had an American, right? She probably thought I'd give her $100 million. Anyway, I screamed at her and she went like that and ran away. It's not because I lack compassion. Although there are those who think I do, but not the people who know me well. Okay. So, in meditation, we're taking a position of no relationship to our experience. In contemplation, we're meditating on something. So in thinking, I'm actively investigating an issue, but in contemplation, I just ask a question. What should I do? I need information about this. And then I let go of my mind completely, and material just starts arising. And sooner or later, something arises, I go, that's it. But I wasn't thinking, it had nothing to do with thinking. And where that information is coming from, I really couldn't say. Freud might have said from the unconscious, but I think it's coming from a place that isn't personal. So Jung might have said the collective unconscious, but I still think that's limited. Who knows? And why do you think they're your thoughts? You know what I've realized in clinic? You know what my definition of insanity is? A person who pays attention to thoughts that they have, when if another person said the exact same words to them, they'd slap them and never speak to them again. You see? So if a patient was coming to my clinic and met a friend an hour early for tea, and the friend said, why are you in Stockbridge today? And the person said, well, I'm going to have my first acupuncture session. I'm really intent on losing weight this time. And if the friend said, you losing weight, you've dieted 7 times, you've never been successful before, you don't really want to lose weight, and why should you deny yourself everything, anything? You don't get enough sex or understanding from your husband, and you give and give and give and give to your kids, and they don't, what do you get from them? Bupkis. What's the point? So if their friend said this, they'd never want to speak to the person again. But they'll repeat the exact same thing to me as if it's important, because they're thinking it. That's crazy. Do you understand? That's completely insane. So you can just pay attention to this with yourself and with your friends. But they're just thoughts. Why are those so special? Because they're yours. Thoughts, feelings, and emotions aren't you. There's none of you in them. Does anyone in here think they've ever had an emotion that nobody else had? If I was in your body, would I be like Spock on the Enterprise when he ate that weird fruit? What is this bold and wondrous new experience? No. I'd say, you know, she's angry or she's happy or, you know, he's curious. If you were in my body, you'd recognize every experience. I think it's coming through the wall. I'm not sure what that was. Okay, so thinking is active. Contemplation, you're asking a question, material's arising. It's very important to know how to contemplate, right? And then thinking is what the mind is doing. Contemplation has more to do with being in touch with one's own soul, right? The deepest part of oneself. The part of oneself that is closest to the infinite. Right? The deepest part of oneself that is still personal, but connected to the infinite. So, we have this small personal sphere. Something just occurred to me. I'll do something I haven't done before. So, we have this small personal sphere. The small personal sphere, I, me, mine. My thoughts, my feelings, my emotions, my conclusions about everything I've experienced and what it meant about me, and all of that is happening in an infinite context. And what have I just drawn? It's a Chinese coin. Right? So we have heaven, the circle, earth, and then in the middle, this the connection to emptiness. Right? The connection to emptiness. So just interestingly, let's look at how would we differentiate what's going on in that square? How would we differentiate it? Well, let's draw an XYZ graph where the front of the graph is excess, the rear of the graph is deficiency, the top of the graph is exterior, the bottom of the graph is interior, the rod of the graph is warm and the left is cold. You generate all the syndrome patterns in TCM by moving a dot anywhere in here. So you can have external excess cold, excess interior cold, excess interior heat, exterior deficiency with presence of warmth. TCM, a principal pattern differentiation, is thermodynamics. Okay? It's Chinese thermodynamics. And all of that is happening in an infinite context, an energetic, a spiritual context, and we diagnose that more with five element constitution. Okay? Five is an odd number. Eight is an even number. The thing about even numbers is there's no center. So they're correlated more with Earth, eight principles more with Earth, but with odd numbers, you always have the center point of that one line. That one line is heaven, more associated with spirit. First character in the Chinese language, the one, the realization of the one. Okay, so let's talk about what consciousness is. I'm told we have a break in 5 minutes. My inclination would be to go straight through the 3 hours, but I'm not going to. We'll break, but 10 minutes, okay? None of this like going to the bookstore and looking at the needles for the 400th time this weekend. Believe me, the action is in here for right now. So just 10 minutes, get a drink, go to the bathroom, please come back. Because I get very finite time here. 6,000 miles round trip. So I shouldn't even be wasting it saying this, you're thinking, and you're right. So consciousness is the infinite field that the mind is occurring within. It has two capacities. It perceives and it chooses. Consciousness can perceive, we might call that witnessing. Consciousness is aware, it's conscious, but it also makes choices in relationship to what it's perceiving. When you're meditating, the only choice you have to make is sit still, back straight, don't move, have no relationship to the content of consciousness. The phone rings, forget it. Right? Knock comes on the door, forget it. When you're really meditating, if you're really meditating, you have no relationship to your experience. That's the only choice you have to make. So when you're meditating, the chief capacity of consciousness that is activated is the capacity to just perceive, to witness. And what you're supposed to be witnessing is not all the thoughts, feeling, and emotions that you're having. You're supposed to be letting go and having no relationship to them and going deeper and deeper and deeper into emptiness. Anyone ever go scuba diving? Yeah? Cozumel? You're 10 feet underwater. You're 10 feet down, so let's say the top of the water's there, and you step off and it goes 6,000 feet straight down. And you jump off and you start floating down, and then you feel this allure to just go forever. And you're for a little while you're really interested in the fish, but after a while you're just focused entirely on the place between the fish. And this infinite pull of this infinite depth, and you're just sinking and sinking and sinking and sinking. And you can feel that it's in the room. Like right now, there's this heaviness. Not heavy in a bad way, but there's a gravity, there's a sobriety, there's this field. And it's like you don't want to take a break. You're in your chair. Things are interesting. Okay, having said that, we'll come back after the break. Thank you.